This is Ridgely speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The Hoosier Environmental Council is getting ready for the 2020 General Assembly session by outlining their agenda for the upcoming lawmakers to talk about and consider when the lawmakers come back to the State House in January. And to find out more about the legislative agenda and also, too, about a very special program that happened just this past weekend, we have Jesse Carbonda. He's the Executive Director of the Hoosier Environmental Council with us. And as always, Jesse, thank you for joining us here on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Always nice to be with you, Chris.
Well, let's start with the heavy lift here. We know that this is a short legislative session compared to last year, and there are a number of things that were up on the table last year that didn't get considered and didn't make it through. What's on the agenda for the Hoosier Environmental Council in the upcoming session, and are we going to see a repeat on some of the topics that were brought up last time?
That's right, Chris. You know, one of the things that we like to impart on audiences that we engage is that any kind of important proactive legislation that's going to have a big impact on people's lives is going to take a few years to pass. And so even though it can be tiresome to hear common topics year after year, that's just the mindset we all need to have, that it can take 3 to 5 years for big bills to pass. With that background stated, some of our priorities will be to try to get a statewide transit bill moving forward. This is a bill that would give the same authority that central Indiana counties now have to every county in Indiana, such that subject to a referendum and approval by either a city or county or township, that local entity could enact a local transit tax to significantly scale up their buses and paratransit services. That's one important initiative that we're going to be advancing. Another is to try to make sure that solar energy is more affordable and accessible in Indiana. There, we want to see if there are ways to either repeal this anti-solar energy bill that became law in 2017, or at least roll it back so that it isn't as harmful to folks who want to go solar than the current law is.
I know there was a measure that was put up in the last General Assembly session that if it had passed would have probably prevented homeowners associations from making it very difficult for their members that might want to go solar to be able to put the arrays up either on their houses or on their property, to be sure, and that bill didn't make it. Do you think that this is going to be something very similar, or is this going to be incorporated in the measure you think will come up this next session?
Yes, I'm glad you raised that, Chris. That's right. There's been an effort for the last few years to try to get a bill through that really reduces the regulatory burdens on homeowners to go solar. And in particular, what it does is that there are covenants across Indiana that are in homeowner association covenants that either outright ban rooftop solar, or they put on really onerous restrictions like, well, you can't have solar. Ground-mounted solar, period, which is really quite extreme. And so the idea is to replace that type of heavy-handed regulation with things that are more common sense and safety-oriented, like not having a solar panel jut from the rooftop, which could be a danger both to the homeowner as well as the neighbor. And so that bill did pass through the House and the Senate last year, which was a pretty big landmark in the evolution of that bill's progress. But then it died in conference committee. Mm-hmm. And so definitely we hope for that to come back.
I know the other question that comes up, too, and it's all linked with solar, of course, is the net metering issue, because we know that as people put arrays up on their homes, they're able to basically kick their electric bill back in cost because they can ship more energy out than they probably take in. I know there was a measure last time also that it would try to reinstate those higher net metering rates in Indiana, but they didn't even get a hearing. Is that another measure that the Hoosier Environmental Council is going to ask for this time next?
We are going to continue to tout that. I think given the enormous political power of the utilities in the General Assembly, that may be a heavy lift. So what we're wanting to really focus on is to educate lawmakers on public policies that are the next phase of making solar energy more accessible and affordable. In particular, I'm thinking of things like PACE financing, third-party financing, and third-party community solar. These are public policies that have been adopted in several Midwestern states and across the country. And again, in essence, they make solar energy more affordable and accessible. So, for example, if someone doesn't have the cash to install solar, or maybe they just don't feel like they want to take on a loan to put up solar, then what has happened in a number of states is the allowance for something called third-party solar. And the idea is that you lease solar panels from a third party, generally a solar installer that folks are already acquainted with, and they pay essentially a rental fee per month for use of the energy that's produced by those solar panels. There's another model called solar power purchase agreements where you're paying for the electrons that are generated by that solar panel. And neither approach, third-party leasing or third-party power purchase agreements, are legal in Indiana.
Mm-hmm. I know that in the past that you've gotten some support from both sides of the aisle on some of the issues, and I know that I'm sure you probably feel maybe this General Assembly session coming up that the battle for solar might be more attainable. I guess that you understand that there are several GOP members that actually are interested in this.
Yes, that's right. You know, we are holding out hope that the political climate in the General Assembly will change to be more pro-solar. A very good silver lining in what arose in 2017 with regard to SB 309, this very controversial anti-solar bill. The silver mm-hmm. lining was that even if the bill became law and was unfortunately signed by Governor Holcomb, the good news is that four members of the Republican House Republican leadership actually were opposed to the bill, which was a landmark as far as leaders of the majority party standing up for the interests of the public as opposed to the interests of the utilities.
We're talking with Jesse Carbonta. He's the executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council about the items that the HEC wants to put up before lawmakers as they get ready for their General Assembly session next year. You talked a little here at the outset of our conversation about public transportation. If you will, bring us up to date first, I guess, on for those of us here in the northern part of the state that aren't as familiar with always what goes on around the center of the state, in particular on public transportation. Tell us about how that seems to work down there and what the expansion statewide would really mean.
Sure. Well, Indianapolis passed a referendum in 2017 in 2016 mm-hmm. That ultimately led to an ordinance being enacted in 2017 that led to the enactment of a transit tax in Marin County, where Indianapolis is. And that, in turn, played an important role in the expansion of bus services in Marin County, both in terms of frequency of buses, in terms of extended routes, and in helping to pave the way for the first all-electric bus rapid transit line in the United States, which is in Indianapolis. It's called the Red Line. And the Red Line's been operating since October of this year, and it's had excellent ridership. It has had some operational challenges. For example, the lifespan of these batteries in light of cold weather. But that's true of any new technology, that it's going to have some hiccups to it. And so the idea, again, is to, by having this bill, SB 285, that actually passed out of the Indiana Senate last year, if we can get this into law, it allows local governments anywhere in Indiana to do something similar to what happened in Indianapolis.
I know the HEC has worked for many years to try to encourage cleaner water all around, not only drinking water and also the water that we use for other purposes. And you're very concerned about pollution in general. Stormwater pollution, I understand, is going to be one of the other things that was likely to come up. Is that something that that you and the staff have been working on for some time? Maybe it came up maybe for at least a try last year. It didn't make it, but we'll go up again in 2020?
Well, to that end, Chris, one of the landmark activities that happened last session with respect to the environment was that one of the bills created a first ever stormwater control task force, and that met earlier this year, and it produced some recommendations that we believe will translate into legislation. There's I think an increasing recognition that stormwater is a major unaddressed, largely unaddressed problem in our state, and that it's going to get worse. From our vantage point, it is going to get worse based on what we're seeing from the Purdue Climate Change Research Center, that storms are going to get more intense and more frequent, and that means that we need to make sure that we have the proper stormwater infrastructure in our state. You know, one of the areas that we've been honing in on, and in fact was covered in our annual public policy conference this Saturday, is green infrastructure, mm-hmm. the idea of making communities have more permeable pavement, more green roofs, any kind of thing that can mitigate the impact of stormwater. And of course, that's a very live issue in Northwest Indiana when we think about what happened with respect to flooding of the Little Cow last year.
That's right.
Which affected no less than three communities in your part of the state.
And I'm glad you mentioned it. At least it got us into the topic of the annual Greening the Statehouse event last weekend there in Indianapolis. Tell us a little bit how things went, and you had a very special speaker. Tell us what he had to talk about and helped enlighten everybody about it.
Absolutely. Well, we had nearly 500 people there, Chris, and including a good contingent, I must say, from Northwest Indiana, and we honored Save the Dunes with the award of Organization of the Year, our highest honor. So we're proud to give props to our friends up in Northwest Indiana. With respect to our keynote speaker, this gentleman was a John F. Kennedy Profiles in Courage awardee. His name is Congressman Bob Inglis, or I should say former Congressman Bob Inglis, and he is a very conservative lawmaker who really has made it his mission after losing office, largely because he took a strong stand for climate action. He's made his post-political career focused on engaging conservatives on climate change. And there was once a time in our country when climate change and climate action were really embraced across the political spectrum. I pointed out in my introductory remarks, Chris, that there was once a time when there was a commercial that was filmed by a former Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, and current Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, talking about the need for bipartisan climate action. Well, that bipartisanship is frayed, but Congressman Inglis has been really key to trying to bring back conservatives to the fold in working on climate action. And he really talked about the importance of engaging the worldview of conservatives to accept that conservatives have a different way of thinking about things and to engage them on their own terms.
I imagine he's probably had his hands full trying to deal with the changes. And of course, we have as you mentioned, the relationships that have been fraying, certainly in the last few years, and in turn on this topic of climate change and of global warming and other issues as well.
That's right. And, you know, he's just been relentless. He has actually been to about 50 cities in 2019 alone. And, you know, one mark that bipartisanship is coming back to climate action is the fact that Senator Mike Braun, just this year, chose to become the co-founder of a Climate Solutions Caucus in the U.S. Senate. And that's a pretty remarkable breakthrough, and there are other Republican senators who've now joined that caucus. So the hope there is that we may once again be back to the kind of bipartisan action that we need on this gravest of challenges.
And we'll see what happens. Coming up tomorrow at the State House, it's Organization Day, where the lawmakers come back in just for the day to talk about some of the issues that they will have to deal with, housekeeping matters and like, and getting ready for the 2020 General Assembly session. And we know that the Hoosier Environmental Council will definitely be there tomorrow for Org Day, as well as there's the rest of the session when it begins next month, or actually, I should say 2 months from now, really. And Jesse Carbonda is the Executive Director of the Hoosier Environmental Council. Thank you for spending some time with us today to talk about what the legislative agenda is going to be for the 2020 session, and also bring us up to date as to how the Greening the Statehouse event went this past weekend.
I really appreciate it, Chris, and I should mention that at Org Day tomorrow, there's going to be a redistricting coalition rally on the east entrance of the Statehouse. So we would love to see some folks come from Northwest Indiana there.
Well, duly noted. Thank you very much, Jesse. Appreciate talking today.
Thank you very much, Chris.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. The City of Portage is going to promote the diversity of the city and its residents by taking action on its human rights ordinance. And Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson had a chance to speak with Portage Mayor John Cannon about the initiative.
Concerning the human rights ordinance, now I'm wondering what prompted this, because isn't this something that had been ongoing that, you know, all cities do? They kind of, they respect the rights, follow the Constitution of all people?
Sure. This ordinance came out of a conversation after a 21-page ordinance was presented to the ordinance committee back in 18, and the ordinance committee voted that down, and then that was just going to be the end of it. So I asked, as a member of the very, 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 very minority on the city council, to have a human rights ordinance adopted. It wasn't 21 pages, of course, but actually covered everything in that 21 pages about the actual person or the problem instead of the procedure. This was passed right around January of 18, and when I got here to the mayor's office, I went around the buildings and met folks and talked to folks, obviously our employees. And I noticed that we didn't have anything in our buildings about human rights and discrimination and lack of and such. So because it was election season already, I didn't want this to be a political issue. So I waited until after the election, 2 weeks ago, to make sure these are posted in all of our public buildings that the city owns. And there's 10 of them. And we are by Monday, these will be posted in view of residents and guests in all of our buildings.
What does the ordinance cover? What does it protect?
Well, it's I believe we sent that in the press release. The whole thing here, but that we are committed as a city to uphold the human rights of all persons in Portage, including citizens and citizens of other nations. And to the free exercise and enjoyment of any and all rights and privileges of the Constitution of the United States and the state of Indiana. So I don't believe that's posted anywhere in our city. I haven't been able to find that anywhere. And the city welcomes individuals of diverse racial, ethnic, religious, and national backgrounds, and we recognize that our diversity is critical to our economic, culture, and social progression of our region and our city.
Does it protect LGBT and people of? Does it protect people of various gender?
Well, I can read that part for you as well.
Sure.
The city calls upon all city officials and employees to respect the human rights and civil liberties of all members of this community and eliminate discrimination based on race, ethnicity, national origin, religion, sexual orientation, gender identity, age, disability, and veterans status. So I think that covers your question. And I want this to be in prominent places in our buildings, so visitors and residents know this is what Portage stands for, and that we're a diverse community, and we welcome that, and we don't discriminate. And if they do discriminate, this is actually a way for them to say, "Hey, who do I talk to about this ordinance? Because I've been discriminated against." And then that's where it would prompt that to go to the mayor's office.
What would happen to someone who didn't follow the ordinance and discriminated against somebody in a protected class? What would be the penalty?
Well, we already had that incident happen in the city. We had an employee in the city that wanted to that broke this ordinance, and that person was terminated from employment from the city. So that's how stern I am on it. And I don't know what would have happened if it had been a different mayor, but that's where I'm at on it. I'm not saying the ordinance would have, if there would have been an ordinance one way or the other, mm-hmm. it still would have happened because our policies and procedures in our city handbook and such has all this in it.
Can you elaborate on the incident further?
No, that's it. That's all I'm not really at liberty to talk about that other than that's why the person was terminated.
That's Portage Mayor John Cannon speaking with Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson. Sending a child to overnight camp can be nerve-wracking for any parent, and it's even scarier if they have a youngster that has a chronic illness. There is a camp, of course, that has the same kind of safe kind of option that in turn would help youngsters who have type 1 diabetes. And we find out more from Side Effects Public Media's Steph Whitesides.
Okay, ready? Follow me, okay? Put your hand down. Need some more.
In the rolling hills of southern Illinois, stable hands get ready to lead a trail ride. Campers get a quick lesson and they're off, but not before counselors collect backpacks full of medical supplies.
You got the brakes on. There you go.
There you go.
Hold by the knot, sweetie. Hold
the backpacks show how Camp Beta is different from traditional summer camps. Counselors are dietetic students from Southern Illinois University, and the 26 kids are always accompanied by a nurse and a dietitian.
Our priority is to just let these kids come out and be kids and have fun and do some things that maybe they're not able to do all the time, ride horses, go zip lining, kayaking, things like that, while we're kind of helping them learn how to do these things and still remain safe with type 1 diabetes.
That's diabetic educator and nurse Lisa Nation. She and her colleagues came up with the idea for the camp. Camp Beta is the only camp for type 1 kids in Southern Illinois. It's a short one, only 2 days, but unlike longer camps, it's free.
But there's quite a big cost associated with for the families with those longer camps. So we really wanted to make this inclusive for everyone in our region.
Because kids with type 1 diabetes don't produce any insulin, they rely on injections or an insulin pump to provide it. They need to test their blood sugar and adjust the dose based on food or activity, or risk going into diabetic shock. Amy Stout helped develop the camp, and she says it can be tough for parents to let go, even for a couple days.
The camp itself is for kids that often don't get a chance to go overnight with their friends even, because diabetes is well known to have low blood sugar reactions in the middle of the night.
That can make parents wary of letting their kids out of sight, especially when they can't be sure other adults know how to handle a diabetic emergency. Billy Crippen says Camp Beta is the only camp her daughter has attended, though she wants to go to others.
She's asked, church camp is actually right down the road from here, and she's asked to go, and it makes me a nervous wreck.
Daughter Taylor says she enjoys meeting other kids like her.
Just meeting all the people with diabetes like me and just like having somebody that knows what it feels like. I'm the only one at school that has diabetes, but...
Stout said that shared experience is a goal of Camp Beta. Kids can feel embarrassed about checking their blood sugar and taking insulin before they can eat. But at camp, she's seen kids change, including one girl who didn't want to wear her insulin pump.
Where she brought her insulin pens because she was going to kind of hide them and, you know, go into the bathroom, take her injections and come out to eat. And then when she saw all the rest of the kids were using their insulin pumps, she was like, oh, why didn't I bring my pump, you know?
Camp is also a break for parents who help their children manage the disease. That can be like having a full-time job. It's a task that doesn't stop, even at night, says Crippen.
When everybody else is tired, wants to wind down and go to sleep, somebody has to be vigilant in the night.
That can get tiring for parents and kids. Taylor admits that she sometimes avoids telling her parents when she has a low, though her younger sister often tells them for her.
There are some moments when I'm trying to hide my low so I could just do what normal kids normally just get to do.
And getting to have that kind of normal kid experience, even if it's only for a couple of days, is what Camp Beta is all about. Steph Whiteside for Side Effects Public Media.
The independent charitable organization known as Big Shoulders Fund, which has been helping with educational assistance in Chicago, is now turning its attention to Northwest Indiana, and that is in part largely because of the very generous gift from the Bruce and Beth White Family Foundation. With us to talk about not only the gift, but also some of the work that is going to be done with the money is Josh Hale. He's the president and CEO of the Big Shoulders Fund. And Mr. Hale, thank you for joining us here on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Thanks very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Take a moment, if you will, tell us a little bit about the Big Shoulders Fund and your overall mission and goal in certainly in Chicago and now shifting to Northwest Indiana.
Big Shoulders Fund is a nonprofit independent charitable organization that was founded back in 1986 at the inspiration of Cardinal Bernardine, but by a group of business and civic leaders who were working really overall to strengthen the city of Chicago by really ensuring that all children have access to a quality education. And the second largest system of schools then and now is the Catholic schools. Mm-hmm. And so they came together and formed this this foundation, really to raise funds to provide access. How to assure that every child found the right school, their parents knew that they were in the right place in a safe and structured environment. And over time, you know, at the onset, we were primarily focused on scholarships. But over time, we have really broadened our investments to focus certainly on the child, ensuring that he or she has the resources to attend the school of their choice, but also that they have the supports. And that's, you know, whether it's after school or before school, it's tutoring, it's coach, whatever it is, mentorship, and really kind of surrounding the child with all the tools they need to succeed from elementary school to high school and really then into college. But we also started to invest in ensuring that these schools we support remain open and viable. You know, first and foremost, these schools represent a community-based organization in the neighborhoods they serve, a beacon of hope, a open and operating institution, and we want to make sure that they were not only open, but that they provided the very best product. So we've increasingly invested in teachers and classrooms, and that's everything from recruiting teachers into a pipeline from right out of college into our classrooms, supporting them, coaching them, helping them to understand the data associated with each of their students, finding great curriculum, and then training them and supporting them, and helping really students to succeed at a higher level. And so academics in the classroom are a big part of it, and creating a pipeline of teachers and principals over time. Mm-hmm. And then the third area is really the business side of the school, because at the end of the day, these inner-city Catholic schools are about a $1 to $1.5 million business. And so we really work with a principal who's primarily an academic leader, but has been asked to really run the quote-unquote business. So helping them with operational support, whether that's cash flow management or it's budgeting or developing a long-term plan or marketing, all those things that come into running a small business successfully. And the third area really is leadership. How do we help overall not only attract and develop the best principals, but retain them over time? So those are four areas we invest. We work with 75 schools here in Chicago, all of them elementary except 13. And it's about 20,000 children, 80% minority, about 70% poverty. And I would say their success rate is what we really hang our hat on, is that it's great that we have these schools open as community-based organizations. It's great to provide access and we invest. But we also want to know that these students really go on to succeed in life and to become great citizens. And so we take that seriously, and we really track outcomes. So we graduate, our high schools see about a 94% graduation rate. Our scholars go on to college at very high rates. We see them not only graduating high school, but actually enrolling in high school at about 86%. And then we see about 92% of them persist. And of those going on to college, 80-plus percent are going to four-year universities. And then the long-term, you know, is a matriculate through college, we see that our students are graduating college at 2 times the national rate, and for African-American and Hispanic students, that's 3 times and 4 times, respectively. So they're succeeding. They're getting through college. But we also look at long-term, how many of them have remained in Chicago, given that it's been our focus. And we see about 85% of our alumni living in the Chicagoland region, and about 60% living in the city of Chicago. They're employed at a higher rate than their peers. They're volunteering at a higher rate than their peers. They're earning at a higher rate than their peers. But they're also donating to charities. They're active in the community and really becoming the citizens that we all dream they could become. And I think that's ultimately our long-term goal, is really to make sure these students from under-resourced communities become the citizens and contribute to society that we all know they can become.
How did Big Shoulders... I'm sorry.
That's a kind of a nutshell of how we work mm-hmm. at Big Shoulders Fund. Right. And we're very excited about this opportunity to be invited into and starting our work in Northwest Indiana. And, you know, we really, given our mission is to serve in under-resourced communities, the invitation of Beth and Bruce White to develop a program, the openness, the enthusiasm of all the folks we've met in Northwest Indiana, from community leaders to families, to principals in the diocese has been overwhelming. And we share a lot of the same values and desires, and we're very hopeful.
How did the Big Shoulders Fund get together with the White Family Foundation to take up this topic, and certainly to take up this long range, since we're talking about $16 million over a decade, $16 million that's going to be eventually being invested into the Catholic schools?
Yeah, we got to know Beth and Bruce, who's both their roots are in Indiana. Bruce, obviously, from Northwest Indiana, and Beth from Southwest Indiana. And they were living in Chicago, had moved here about a decade ago, and some friends on our board introduced them to Big Shoals Fund. And they were enthusiastic about the mission right from the get-go, and they got involved with one of our schools in the far southeast side of Chicago, which is just on the border of Indiana, and a school that was really struggling and but provided a great outcome in terms of student success. And they adopted that school and invested, helped us to invest in academic programming, marketing, all the things that I've talked about. That school is doing phenomenal and remains a strong community-based organization in a neighborhood that continues to need that sort of presence. Mm-hmm. They also started a scholarship program which supports hundreds of students around Chicago. And with Beth and Bruce, what I've learned is when they get involved, they get involved. And they got not only themselves involved as mentors, but they invited their children. They invited their friends. And they have many mentors of these students now. And I love, you know, Beth and Bruce come back and talk to us about the students they've been out visiting, the students' performances they've gone to see. They invite their scholars down for shows. So hands-on involved in the mission, really active. And, you know, I think the mission fell in love with Beth and Bruce as much as they had fell in love with the mission. And they were increasingly, you know, interested in doing something in Northwest Indiana. And when they approached us, they said, you know, we really believe that the work you're doing here could be a benefit in Northwest Indiana, that we really want to invest, that we really want to see something long-term that strengthens the region, that really brings vitality and a reason why people want to stay and live and really see a trajectory for their children to get to a brighter future. And our immediate, and this was about a year and a half ago, our immediate answer was absolutely. And they knew better than we did that we had some work ahead of us. And one was, you know, certainly our board here understanding the opportunity and believed that we could take this on and be successful, but also going to understand really the needs in Northwest Indiana. And so we worked with a third-party firm to really get to know community leaders, parents, families, the schools, and talking to them and understanding the schools that we would be working with. And we saw really, you know, some great schools, but an opportunity for them to grow even more. And that is in the sense of student success and the viability of those schools, but also that this could be an engine of good in the region, as we've seen here in Chicago. Of Big Shoals is really shrinking the city, bringing people together, and in a mission of helping children. And so Beth and Bruce, while it's an enormous amount of money, $16 million is an enormous number, I think they have said very publicly, we agree that this is we really believe just a start. You know, we want to focus primarily first on getting those schools and getting some investments there to continue to strengthen them. We also want to then reach out into the community and how do we get local businesses and others in the community to take a part in those schools, whether it's mentorship or helping to get these students out to their businesses to learn about career paths, making all sorts of connections and inviting others to support this mission, because of the long-term impact and the data that we can start to show over time of students coming back and really contributing and carrying this tradition on for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned here the fact that you have some partnerships that you have planned. Do you have any here in Northwest Indiana that are getting started already, even though this is just really the beginning of a decade-long project?
No, well, you know, it's amazing since we just started, you know, a couple months ago, really, you know, with the announcement and the news. What was amazing is how many calls we had from individuals, from heads of companies, from community organizations saying, how can I help? How can I get involved? You know, it was also interesting to hear, even here in Chicago, how many people who grew up in that area said, you know, I went to such a school. I'm from that community. I want to help too. But really from the region. And so we haven't you know, started any formal partnerships, but we are definitely having those meetings. And what we want to be careful of is, you know, making sure that we have infrastructure in place to really support those. If I've learned one thing in my work at Big Shoals Fund, I hope I have, you know, to make sure that you can support partnerships, that when a company or an individual signs on, you want to make sure that everything's engaged. And so we want to make sure that we've set that up. We've hired two people, both from the region, and they have hit the ground running and have a lot of relationships. But they're also getting to know each of the principals and the schools and each one of their needs. And we're trying to cut across them and say, what will be those first investments? We don't come in, as we work with our schools here, it's not a we come out and say we're going to do this and that. It's really starting with talking to leaders in these schools and listening to what they say, but also looking at data around academics, enrollment, financial stability, and saying, all right, where's there's commonalities and how can we find a way to invest and start to create connections between the schools to share professional development or coaching and supports. And coming out of that, we also then want to invite others in. We don't want to hurt the opportunity for a partnership by not having things set up and in place. So we are on the ground getting to the place and listening. We found starting to get, you know, tremendous feedback, you know, kind of saying what the needs are.
Well, Mr. Hale, thank you for spending time with us to talk a little bit about, first, about the Big Shoulders Fund and how it's done very well in Chicago and now expanding into helping Northwest Indiana, and in particular, the Gary Diocese Catholic Schools. Thank you for being with us to talk about it, and we hope we have more chances to talk again in the future as this project is going to go on for quite some time, and there'll be a lot of things that will get rolled out over time. But thank you for spending a little time with us today to talk about it.
Chris, thanks so much. I appreciate it. We're excited to be down in the region and look forward to meeting you at some point.
That's wonderful. Josh Hale is the president and CEO of the Big Shoulders Fund, who, with the generous help of the Bruce and Beth White Family Foundation, $16 million over 10 years, are going to be helping expand and do some major changes and good for the Catholic schools in Northwest Indiana. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The Valparaiso City Redevelopment Commission is making funds available for more neighborhood improvement projects again this year. The Director for Community Engagement, Maggie Clifton, was on Regionally Speaking to talk about the program and the more than one dozen projects that are getting grants in 2019.
Strengthening our neighborhoods is a big priority of Mayor Costas, and so the Redevelopment Commission was able to put some funding towards neighborhood improvement projects. So then when I started in my role, we thought it made the most sense to turn it into more of a grant program. So last year was the pilot year, and we were able to fund 8 projects. And this year in 2019, we've seen an increase in demand, and we were able to fund 14 projects that were submitted at some level, totals at about $132,000 of grant awards coming from the city. So the main goal of the program is really to bring our neighborhoods together, so it's giving them a reason to talk to one another, come up with a shared goal, and really work together and have direct input into what those improvement projects might be. So it helps us as well as the city build a relationship with these neighborhoods and really work together on a shared project.
I know in a lot of communities there are very similar programs to this, grant programs, and a lot of them, and of course even the federal government for that matter, the community development block grant program system is based on not only seeing neighborhoods get together, but to even help on some of the cost of some of the projects. Are you finding that's the case in some of these neighborhoods and have Valparaiso, that they'll get a match, so to speak, from their neighbors?
We're really lucky here with the funding coming from the Redevelopment Commission here locally. We can kind of use our own rules and guidelines for how these projects are funded. So mm-hmm. We have a little bit less restrictions than some of the federal grants. We're able to fund the projects, and oftentimes there is a match coming from the neighborhood. So we're granting about $132,000 this year, but the total impact of the projects will be nearly $180,000. So the neighborhoods are also chipping in quite a bit.
What types of projects are these, and just in general, and then we can go through each individual neighborhood of all of those that have gotten the support this year. But what in general kind of projects can the funding be used for?
We're talking about if they want to add an enhancement to their local park, if they want to do something with sidewalks or more infrastructure in their neighborhood. We've seen some creative landscaping ideas that have come to be signage, but really, you know, the projects are important and they're really neat to be a part of, but we're really most excited about, you know, the increase in neighborhood communication and the increase in a sense of community in our neighborhood.
How did the city of Valparaiso get the neighborhoods to individually or maybe even collectively seek the grant program and get their share of the funds that are available? Did they come in and talk to folks at City Hall, talk with the mayor, talk with you and other people in redevelopment department about this? So you had, they had an idea and what City Hall basically to come up with the request for a proposal that would have to be considered?
Kind of a combination of those things. So the community engagement department, my department really administers the program, and mm-hmm. so I try to do a lot of outreach to get people aware of it as I'm out connecting with neighborhoods. And then as their ideas were kind of bubbling up, we were able to pull in other departments. So if it was a sidewalk project, we pulled in the Public Works Department, and same with the parks or a stormwater project. We made sure that we were all kind of working hand in hand. That way their application was as feasible as possible when it was submitted.
Let's go through the list, and we can go through alphabetically if you choose. Tell us about each individual neighborhood that's going to be getting grants for 2019.
All right. So Audubon neighborhood, they are going to get funding for sidewalk missing links in their neighborhood. Bonta neighborhood wants to work with their local elementary schools to do creative crosswalks, which is basically street art at certain intersections. Beauty Creek Villas, they're also doing sidewalk missing links. Central neighborhood will be getting sign toppers, so they'll be the second neighborhood in the city to have those, as well as a neighborhood tree planting. Sandana Point will be getting uniform residential lights. College Hill will be having a neighborhood build next year to add toddler park equipment to their existing park. Concord Woods, they are getting a pathway link that will connect them to a nearby park. Greenfield Creek is getting funding to have two little free libraries in their neighborhood. Harrison West is going kind of half and half with us on landscaping bioswales in their neighborhood, enhancing those. Jesse Pfeiffer will be doing a variety of park enhancements, which could include fencing and signage. Keystone Commons is working on enhancing their common area sidewalk area right there where they have the gazebo. Pine Creek wants a new entrance sign. Sierra, they're looking at sidewalk improvements throughout their neighborhood, and Villas at Vail Park is looking at landscaping and adding some trees to their neighborhood.
Have you discovered if some of these neighborhoods that have asked for the support with the grant program are maybe in more need of improvement? That is, maybe they're not, I would not say run down necessarily, but they're older neighborhoods, some of the original neighborhoods in the city of Valparaiso, to be sure, and they may need a little extra help, and this is why they come to you and the grant program?
That's a good point. Through this process of talking one-on-one with more neighborhoods, we've been able to hear from them on other things that they would like to see more attention given to. So for one example of that would be in Audubon, they really wanted street lighting out by their neighborhood entrance. So we thought, you know, that's something we do kind of outside of this grant program, come to our traffic and safety committee. And since then, we've made the recommendation that there should be street lights there. So now we're going to work on getting that done outside of this grant program. Mm-hmm. So we're able to really open that line of communication and see results, not just for their grant application, but with other needs that they might have that they think is a priority.
Now, since this is a program that actually just got started last year in 2018 and continuing this year, what kind of input, feedback, so to speak, that have you received from not only participants in the grant program, but also just citizens in general in Valparaiso?
I think the majority of it has been very supportive of this opportunity. You know, residents having direct input into where some city dollars are going, I think that's an important feature of this program. We always do a feedback survey to applicants after each round, so I can tell you that feedback has been really positive.
Oh, good.
And a lot of them really know, you know, it's nice kind of understanding our local government more and having those lines of communication open. It's not always so focused on the project, but it's just kind of the overall feeling of, oh, we got together with our neighbors and it was successful. We can now celebrate this win together. I think overall the feedback is positive. We're always thinking about, you know, what will this look like next year? How can we maybe tailor it to better meet the needs of our neighborhoods and projects that they might want in the future?
That's Maggie Clifton with the City of Valparaiso. A Northwest Indiana state representative wants to lower the age limit to serve in the Indiana House, the Indiana Senate, to 18 years old. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith tells us about Democrat Chris Chung's proposal to change the Indiana Constitution.
The state constitution sets the age limit to serve in the Indiana Senate at 25 years old, 21 years old for the House. A proposed constitutional amendment would change those limits to 18. Megan Stoner is a Republican activist who's been working on this issue for a few years.
When we have more young Hoosiers as elected officials, we will have fresh ideas, a young Hoosier spirit embodied within the State House.
Representative Chris Chung says the idea is one that should be appealing to both parties.
Republicans and Democrats are looking to the future in order to build their majorities, in order to build their constituencies and lead the way of the future in making important change in this state and in this nation.
Chung says he hasn't yet gotten a Republican co-sponsor for his amendment for the coming session. Without one, it's unlikely to advance. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
And with another edition of Eye on the Arts, here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Amber Ray Mack, a ballerina soloist and costume mistress with Indiana Ballet Theater. Amber, it's wonderful to have you here.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. And how long have you been affiliated with Indiana Ballet Theater?
I joined Indiana Ballet Theater in 2005, fresh out of college. This will be my 14th season dancing professionally with them.
Fantastic.
Yes.
So we are going to talk about the Nutcracker. Mm-hmm. It's the time of year for the Nutcracker.
It is.
You have been featured in the Nutcracker, I would assume, over
yes.
the years.
Many, many, many parts.
Well, tell us, when is it going to happen and where is it being performed now that we don't have the Star Plaza Theater
yes.
anymore?
This year, December 6th through the 8th is at Crown Point High School. December 11th through the 14th is at Indiana University. Our school shows are already sold out this year, but we are taking requests for our spring production of Coppelia.
So this is a big success.
Yes.
How long has Gloria Tuohy, of course, the founder of Indiana Ballet Theater, how long has she and your company, have she and your company been performing?
Well, 40 years ago, we started our company in her basement.
Yes.
So we're celebrating our 40th year as a company, and this will be our 22nd year performing the Nutcracker.
Well, that's fantastic. So tell me about some of the performers that are going to bring this classic to life on our local stages.
Yes. We have dancers from all over Northwest Indiana, of course, as well as some traveling in from Illinois, Michigan, and even Florida.
And how many altogether will
there? We have over 100 performers on stage during our finale scene.
Good Lord.
Yes.
That's a heck of a lot of people to corral.
It is. Lots of little feet, too.
So is Gloria the person who herds them?
Yes, she is our founding director, and her daughter, Amanda Tuohy, is our assistant director. They both run our rehearsals.
I see. Mm-hmm. So that is quite a production.
It is a very big production.
When do you start rehearsing for this big
We epic? Had auditions back in September, and we started late September with our rehearsals, most time on the weekend. Our company also rehearses during the week as well.
Where do you rehearse?
Our studio is just right around the corner.
Okay. Oh, from Lakeshore, yep. Lakeshore Public Radio.
Yes.
Here on Mississippi Street in beautiful downtown Merrillville. is there some way that the audience, of course, the audience pays for the ticket and has the pleasure of enjoying the performance? Is there any way that audience members ever get to meet the ballet dancers?
Yes. This year we're doing something a little different. After our Saturday, December 14th show at IUN, we'll be hosting a meet and greet event. The performers will be out in costume. You can take a photo and get an autograph and a chance to see our beautiful costumes up close.
Oh, dear. And those are costumes that you helped to make.
Yes, sir.
Where did the additional interest in costuming come from?
I did a little gig with it in college. I learned how to sew through my director there, and then I started my own design business, and I've been helping out Mrs. T with costumes ever since.
Where did you study?
Northern Illinois University.
Mm-hmm. And did you start being a ballet dancer when you were teeny tiny?
No, I didn't start until I was 14.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, after seeing a production of The Nutcracker on TV. I told my mom I wanted to be a ballerina, and we checked out a book at the library, and it all went from there.
Wow. And you had a gift for it.
Apparently.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So many times they start like when they're really teeny tiny.
Most
in their tutus.
Do. Yes, most do. My children started as well, young. I have three, and my other one started 18
so
months
you
old.
So you put them all in the tutus, whether they liked it or not.
Except for the boys. They don't wear tutus.
I see. Wait, got it. Okay. Well, so after 22 years of doing the Nutcracker, is there anything new in this year's production?
Yes, due to downsized theaters, we have to downsize our props, but this year we added a growing Christmas tree. So it'll be different for our battle scene this year, something new for our audience to enjoy.
So the tree gets bigger and bigger.
It does.
Wow. That sounds like a neat trick.
Yes.
That's interesting. Yeah, that was that 3,400-seat theater, we were all so spoiled.
Very much so.
Yeah, with that, because nothing like it around here. So you've been in the Nutcracker how many times?
14 years now.
Oh, my goodness. You said that before, I know, but I forgot. There's so many statistics, I'm trying to keep up.
Who knew so many numbers in ballet?
Yeah, really. So what, do you have a favorite part of the Nutcracker?
I actually really enjoy the snow scene, but this year I'm one of the 7 featured Claras, which is our title role for the ballet.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Good. Well, it's beautiful music. The
it
whole
is.
Thing is just thrilling. I love the Nutcracker. So how can you get tickets? How can we all get tickets?
Yes, this year tickets are being sold online at http://www.22tix.com/IBT. And for group and special interest rates, please contact our office, info@ibtnw.org.
I like that, 22tix, T-U-T-U-T-I-X.
Yes.
22tix. Okay, great. Well, Amber, Ray, Mack, it was great to have you here, and good luck with the performances.
Thank you.
Sounds like a lot of fun, and thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
And you can hear Eye on the Arts every day, Mondays, here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and of course, you can catch all of the Eye on the Arts conversations on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. That's it for Regionally Speaking today. We're preempted on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, by the House impeachment inquiry hearings, and we'll have those for you from NPR News beginning tomorrow, Tuesday morning at 8 o'clock. We hope you'll join for that.